The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. Whatever stage your business is at, there's always time to imagine sustainable, positive change. AIB, for the life you're after.
But last night, the ghosts and ghouls were out in force. Vampires and villains too. We all know that Ireland is the home of Halloween. And of course, one of the major figures in our gory history is Bram Stoker, the creator of Dracula. People will be familiar with him as a writer, but perhaps less as a business person. Shifra Mulqueen has been sinking her teeth into the story of Bram's business interests.
Just picture yourself walking along the streets of Dublin.
Historian and walking tour operator Pat Liddy takes a step back in time.
They were cobbled. You had the clanking of the trams going by. You had horses pulling carts with metal wheels. At night time in Dublin, everywhere was lit just by gas lamp. There was a lot of crime in the city as well, so most people didn't really venture out at night time. It was a spooky city. How would this not inspire Bram Stoker to create his monster? Bram Stoker was born in Dublin, in Merino Crescent, became very athletic, went to Trinity College. His father had worked for 50 years as a senior civil servant at Dublin Castle. He got his son a job in the offices of the Petty Sessions. Well, we're in the grounds of Dublin Castle. You see that at the corner there, those four windows. These were the windows of the offices of Bram Stoker. There are about 600 petty session courts around Ireland, and they tried small misdemeanors and small civil cases. And in fact, the first book Bram Stoker wrote was The Duties of the Clerks of the Petty Sessions of Ireland. Riveting stuff, I imagine. When he was asked himself, well, what did you think of your first book? He said, dry as dust. But while he was doing that, he was double jobbing, except he didn't get paid for his second job. He was theatre critic for the Evening Mail. Henry Irving, who performed in the Theatre Royal, so liked his criticism, if you will, that he invited Bram Stoker to take up his next job, which was theatre manager of the Lyceum in London. He knocks on the door and he hears the door clanking open. The old man motioned me in with his right hand with a courtly gesture. The instant, however, that I stepped over the threshold, he moved impulsively forward and, holding out his hand, grasped mine with a strength which made me wince, an effect which was not lessened by the fact that it seemed as cold as ice, more like the hand of a dead than a living man. I said, Count Dracula? He bowed in a courtly way as he replied, I am Dracula, and I bid you welcome.
You're frightening me now, Pat.
Trick or treat!
Well, by the age of 12, when you become really aware of Halloween, and we people come to the door, the Stoker house, oh, what are you going to do? You know, give us candy or take the blood. And so I asked my dad, finally, I think it was 12, what's going on? What's the story? And he took me down to the family library downstairs, and there was the first edition of Dracula signed by Bram to his mother. And he said, well, now let me tell you.
Dacre Stoker is a best-selling author and the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker. Dacre says that Bram even had a business plan for seating arrangements when running the Lyceum Theatre.
The dead head was about the necessity to have some people in the theatre even if they weren't paying for a seat. He was very shrewd and figured out exactly how to play the game to get the best value business-wide with the empty seats. The press, he noticed how important it was that the press would come in and give good reviews. Good reviews meant business, so it was promotion. He would, of course, give tickets to tradespeople. These would be painters and carpenters, costume designers, all people that Bram found of value to contribute to the ongoing business of the stage. They would get tickets as a quid pro quo, which turned out to be very good business for both sides. But this was the type of mind that Bram had. The theater is certainly a business, but there's many more ways, we say, to skin the cat. And the one final one was something he learned in France called the clappers. He realized that if you could get people in the audience that would be literally paid by tickets to clap at the right time, that would encourage everybody else to clap, and that would get better performances from the actors. The stage is illusion, isn't it? Off the stage is a bit of an illusion as well.
From Theodore Roosevelt to Mark Twain, Bram was a great networker and investor.
Part of my research was buying at auction for more money than my wife wanted me to. The actual letter was Mark Twain explaining to Bram that the failed Page Compositor investment that Bram and Irving invested in, I think Bram gave maybe £50, which was a lot of money in the day, and this was a small version of a printing press that Mark Twain wanted to have invented, and it went belly up. And it turns out that Mark Twain lost $300,000, but this was the letter of Mark Twain explaining to Bram, I'm bringing you the money back.
Bram had to pivot when his career fell into chaos.
You know, in a business standpoint, Bram did very well while he was working for Irving, but unfortunately Irving died just getting off stage in Bradford and didn't leave Bram a pension, didn't leave Bram any money in his will. So he had to, the last few years of his life, the last 5 years, he had to sort of eke it out by writing stories. So he had to hustle a little bit. You know, his life and business of Dracula, it really didn't start making a lot of money for the family until after he was gone. And nowadays, the whole Dracula business in the world is, you know, could probably support a small country. Horror has taken off, and a lot of it we can go back to how well Bram Stoker packaged a wonderful story to take a myth and make people believe it was true.
Screams, fainting, smelling salts.
Arts and features writer with the Irish Times, Nadine O'Regan.
When Dracula, the play version, was performed in London, I think back in the 1920s, the New York Times ran a piece stating that it had such a harrowing effect upon its audiences that a trained nurse had to be appointed by the theatre's management to attend to sufferers. They also mentioned as a side point that 5 men collapsed for every 1 woman. From a marketing perspective alone, this is gold, you know? I mean, who wouldn't want to go and see a movie or go to a play where, you know, you had to basically have an ambulance on standby? It was maybe one of the first early examples of how marketing could sell a movie above and beyond star presence in the shape of different actors. It was a graveyard smash. Dracula, back in the early 1930s, saved Universal Studios. At the time, Universal was a near bankrupt small studio. It grossed around $1.2 million worldwide when it was initially released. It was a phenomenon. Bear in mind that was during the period of the Great Depression. Whatever happened to my Transylvania twist? Vampire merchandise brings in tens of billions to the Hollywood economy. There are a number of economists and essayists who believe that a proliferation of vampires in our movie climate predicts a recession, while when zombies are big, everyone is fine. Apparently, Charlaine Harris's The Sookie Stackhouse novels, which became the source material for True Blood, and Stephanie Meyer's Twilight novels were both published in the years leading up to a US recession. Meanwhile, The Lost Boys came just months before the Black Monday stock market crash of 1987. So there is a sense that perhaps when we're getting a little bit concerned about the way we're living, vampires start surfacing in our fiction again, and that could predict a crash. Not saying it's gospel, just saying the theory's out there.
Sadly, the world of Dracula lost one of its real creators in September, with the passing of two-time Academy Award-winning makeup artist Michelle Burke. I spoke to Michelle a few years ago about creating that iconic look back in 1992.
The word was around Hollywood that, like, oh my goodness, Francis Ford Coppola wanted a Dracula that no one had ever seen before. And I remember I was having a meeting with Penny Marshall, a famous director, producer, and she said to me, I don't know what the problem is. She has this New York accent, you know. You put the fangs on, you put the cape on, and you got Dracula, you know. And I thought, this is hilarious. I wish it were so simple. The actors, you know, let's say Gary Oldman, at a given point during the makeup, I don't see Gary anymore. I just see Dracula. He, in my mind, is the character I'm creating. I took part in creating the famous iconic hairdo that old Dracula wears. It was a marriage of sort of East meets West. I decided I would combine a kabuki-type idea with a Hopi Indian look, and that's the way you got the swirly hairdo that you see. It's rather like two buns on the head. It was a very dramatic scene where he, you know, creeps right across the set where you see only the fingers in a shadow puppet. And he says, welcome to my home. I could hear the crew snickering. Oh, my God, he looks like Mickey Mouse. my heart just dropped. I mean, that's the death knell, because if a character looks like Mickey Mouse or Batman or something, studio could be sued, you know, and copyright and all that stuff. And so I turned to Eiko, who was the costume designer, and I said, Eiko, what do you think? Do you think Francis likes this? And she said to me, he loves it. So I thought, OK, that's it. It works.
Much missed. The much missed Michelle Burke ending Shaver's report.